From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. Always good to have you along. I'm Evan Dawson.
And I'm Megan Mack. It's been a busy week on Connections, highlighted by a conversation with a man known as the architect of Obamacare, Jonathan Gruber. He's an MIT economist who helped create the Affordable Care Act. Gruber was in Rochester to promote his new book about economic innovation, and he joined us for an hour on Connections.
I had the chance to ask Gruber about the ACA, single payer, and how healthcare is working in this country. Over the last decade, more than 20 million Americans have gotten health insurance that didn't have it before, but the number of Americans with high deductible plans is rising. It's around 45% of Americans with private plans, according to the CDC. And so I asked Gruber a question that is central to understanding healthcare in this country. I asked him, if you have a $6,000 deductible, do you actually have health insurance? Here's his response.
Yes, you do. Let's remember what the word insurance means. It means protection against financial risk. And what's financial risk? It means spending too high a share of your income. For many individuals, a $6,000 deductible, now for a sick individual, hit it year after year after year, that is very high. But for many individuals, they can afford to deal with a one-time shock of $6,000. Okay? And for those individuals, they still have insurance. What they can afford is having a heart attack and having a $100,000 bill. And the problem with insurance before the Affordable Care Act is you could have plans which said, don't worry, you're covered. But by the way, if it's more than $10,000, you're not covered anymore. Now, that's not insurance. That's the opposite of insurance. So, yes, a plan with a $6,000 deductible is insurance, but not for someone who's low, who has low means. That's why in the Affordable Care Act, we actually say if your income's lower, we're going to help offset those deductibles by getting more generous insurance to help offset that.
Okay. And I'm thinking of people who may not go to the doctor if they've got some sort of a medical malady that isn't catastrophic. Maybe it's not a $75,000 broken leg surgery. You're right. That could be bankrupting without insurance. But if people are not going because they have such a high deductible, I'm not sure they really do have full insurance.
Well, look, the thing about healthcare, the number one rule is there's never an easy yes or right or wrong. It's all about trade-offs. The trade-off here is if you make healthcare free for everyone, then no one will be disturbed from going to the doctor, but it will cost us, best estimates are, 20 to 25% more. We already spend $3.5 trillion on healthcare in America. Do we really want to spend another $700, $800 billion? There, on the other hand, we don't want to dissuade people from getting needed care. That's why, once again, the devil's in the details. In the Affordable Care Act, those high deductible plans all include for free two primary care visits, two or three, I forget which, primary care visits a year. So before the deductible, you get to go to have a primary care visit. So we are trying to make that balance. Is the balance right? It may or may not be. That's a debate we should be having as a society, but let's not have that debate be rip it all up and start over. Let's have the debate be, well, maybe it shouldn't be 6,000, maybe it should be 4,000.
Yeah, I definitely see the complexity of a system like this. You can't 5 years into a new system say, well, it didn't work perfectly, throw the whole thing out. I mean, I understand the desire to tweak it, but I also see the popularity increasing of Medicare for All or pick these different. So I guess what I want to make sure I understand from you, Professor Gruber, is, you know, when you say something like Medicare for All or single payer healthcare is not politically feasible, you're really making the argument that it's just not better, that it's not a good idea to begin with, as opposed to politically feasible.
No, I'm not saying that at all.
Okay.
I think there are arguments on either side of single payer, and quite frankly, I don't spend a lot of time thinking at them because it's politically infeasible. Politically infeasible doesn't mean not better. It means let me give you a simple example. I work for the state of Vermont, which wanted to propose single payer. And I thought if it's going to happen anywhere, it's Vermont, right? Leftiest state in the nation. They essentially have one insurer, which is Blue Cross. So I did the modeling for them. I ran the numbers. The good news was if they put in single payer, total healthcare costs in Vermont were going to fall by at least 10%. That's a big win. Okay. The bad news was to pay for it, they had to double the entire taxes collected in the state of Vermont. Now, as an economist, I'd say, well, who cares if you double taxes? You double taxes, but wages go up and it all offsets. And at the end of the day, all we care about is total healthcare spending. That doesn't sell so well on the stump. And the minute those numbers came out, the plan died. So it's not about good idea, bad idea. It's about the fact that it is hard to transition from the status quo, especially, as the Affordable Care Act found out, when you have opponents who will exploit the difficulties and make it sound worse than it is.
But now the argument is, well, you can't do it piece by piece. You'd have to do it sort of whole scale. And I do want to listen to, and I don't know if Professor Gruber is a big fan of Senator Bernie Sanders, but I do want to listen to the comments that he made on a Fox News town hall about this. The headlines really came from the reaction of a Fox News crowd when he was talking about Medicare for All. This is just a couple of days ago. Let's listen.
Millions of people every single year lose their health insurance. You know why? They get fired or they quit and they go to another employer. I was the mayor for 8 years. You know what I did, what probably every mayor in America does? Is you look around for the best insurance program, the most cost-effective insurance. You change insurance. Every year, millions of workers wake up in the morning and their employer has changed the insurance that they have. Maybe they like the doctors. People are nodding their heads. Okay? So this is not new. Every year. Now, what we're talking about actually is stability. That when you have a Medicare for all, it is there now and it will be there in the future.
That's on Fox News, and the applause indicates that maybe the caricature of single payer as something that just the far left wants is gaining more traction elsewhere. Do you buy that?
Look, I wish I bought it, but look at the poll numbers. If you ask people if they support single payer, about 65% say yes. If you simply say, do you support if your taxes have to go up, it drops to 30%. Do you say, do you support if you have to give up the insurance you have now, it drops to 30%. And the bottom line is, I think I love what Bernie's doing as an aspiration. I got in a big debate on Fox News about this, where Fox News would like to say, well, any healthcare reform, you know, it's all single payer. It's not all single payer. We're setting an aspiration. I think what Bernie was doing is laying out the fact this is where we want to get to. It's going to be a road to get there. To say single payer or nothing, to set that litmus test, I think is dangerous.
Next, a conversation about what we can do regarding gun violence in this country. We sat down with two men who just wrapped a 37-city tour promoting their ideas for reducing gun violence. Michael Martin and Shane Claiborne have written a book called Beating Guns, and it's based on the religious concept of beating swords into plowshares.
Martin and Claiborne actually physically turn guns into garden tools. They melt them down and turn an AR-15 into a dual-sided tool with a fork on one side and a hoe on the other. They've made countless tools, sometimes taking a gun that was used in a murder or suicide. And they hold public demonstrations in the hopes of inspiring others. Let's listen.
There are two tools that Shane and I have made together at kind of the first event that we did about 6 years ago. It's a Matic. It has a fork on one side and a hoe on the other. Both are similar styles. One's made from a handgun found in a Philly abandoned house, and the other's made from an AR-15 that was also from the streets of Philly that we did at an event earlier this year before we kicked off this 37-city tour. So we go from semi-automatic to Matic with these tools.
You know, when the first email came in describing your work, describing your book, the idea of beating guns into plows or beating guns into tools, you know, the idea of swords into plows and doing it with guns, I did think when I first read the email it was symbolic. I did not realize you're actually physically doing it. Mm-hmm. And Mike, raw tools, the word raw is war spelled backwards. Tell me about how this first came together.
Well, it was something that has been milling around kind of in a little around since 2010. But then when Sandy Hook happened, that kind of brought the idea and forced us to kind of get off our butts and get to work and learn how to blacksmith so we could do this. It also comes from that swords to plowshares scripture where it also talks about training for war no more and being in fear of no other. And so we use these garden tools and the actual transformation of that metal to make that connection that we need some transformation of our hearts as well and to learn different ways to deal with conflict between each other and within ourselves since suicide is two-thirds of gun violence.
I grew up with guns. I grew up in East Tennessee. But owning a gun for hunting doesn't mean that we believe that AR-15 should be on the streets of Philadelphia or Rochester.
And so when people see the actual tools, they see that you've done it. And I'm not even talking about seeing you actually do the blacksmithing and the actual process. But when you just walked into the studio and you said, yeah, this used to be, what, an AR-15?
Mm-hmm.
That catches your attention. What are the kind of reactions you get around the country when you do that?
Yeah, it's very similar. And then you can tell them, well, I can make four of these out in AR-15. We make one gun every 3 seconds in this country in our gun industry. And so we can kind of flip that on its head and say, well, we can make at least three guns on average out of every gun that is donated to us. And so there's kind of opens up your imagination that, oh, we can do something else with the resources we're given.
I think as we traveled around, this has become more and more personal, and we see the nuances and the dynamics of gun violence. Like when we were in Texas, there were a lot of military folks, and they reminded us that the number one cause of death of military service members is not combat, but suicide. They're dying by their own guns more often than, you know, enemy combatant guns. And so there were a ton of folks that surrendered their weapons and beat on those with, you know, tears rolling down their face for fellow service members that took their own lives. One gun that we had, the last time it was fired, was a military service member taking their life, and their friends and family were there. We had another family that a murder-suicide. A man took his life and his wife's life, and then the family was left with a house full of guns. So it really is moving, and, you know, we're not out just kind of going, hey, we just want everybody's guns, you got to give them over. But we're stirring, I think, a conversation, and we're moving people's hearts. We've literally had folks during our event go home, get their handguns, and bring them back and say, you know what, I really don't want this in my house. I think it's more likely that it's going to hurt someone I love than it would actually protect my family.
We'll end the week in review with a clip from our conversation about the Black Men Achieve Awards. A pair of twin brothers founded the awards 2 years ago in an effort to combat stereotypes about Black men in Rochester. Jermaine and Jamar Myers joined us to discuss their own story, which includes tragedy and the temptation of gang life. Let's listen.
Well, in most households, the man is always the head of the household. And for us in particular, because we had a huge family, you know, we had nine brothers and sisters. Mm-hmm. Many of them were foster brothers and sisters because my mother and father believed in the foster care program and adopted kids from the program who, you know, had difficult lives themselves. So losing my father, you know, at 3 o'clock in the morning, Sunday morning, I'll never forget. Being woken up out of my sleep by my aunt, you know, shaking us violently to wake up, to get dressed. We needed to rush to Rochester General Hospital, where we seen all of our family members there. And then the doctor walked in the room and said that my father was dead. So hearing that, you know, it really didn't register. Because I thought it was a dream. You know, at 11 years old, I thought it was a dream. You know, I'm in my Spider-Man underwear. You know, sleeping in the bed, I got the crust in my eyes, and I'm just being woken up in the middle of the night. So it was all a dream until the next morning when, you know, we fully woke up and we realized that we did just lose our father, the head of our household.
That my mother was crying nonstop.
Yep.
But, you know,
how old were you, Jamar?
We're twins.
Oh, boy. Yeah.
We don't tell folks, but we're twins.
What do you, was it the same kind of memory for you?
The exact same conversation.
I think we were
same
in bunk memory. Beds, right?
Yep.
Wow.
Same room. I always slept on top. You slept at the bottom. So, but it, just the same conversation. Just we remember it to this day. There are certain imagery and certain lessons and just certain smells and just things that are like triggers that just, they don't go away. I mean, they don't go away. And so experiencing that at 11, you know, that forced us to look for a father figure. And unfortunately, we looked for a father figure in the wrong areas. And we began to join gangs. And we began to act out what we didn't think we thought was funny. Behaviors that were not right. They were wrong. These were wrong behaviors. But we did it because when it's all said and done, we wanted attention. We wanted to hear somebody talk to us. We wanted that father figure. And we didn't have that no more.
What kind of do you remember about looking at, for example, gangs to kind of fill that void? Did you have any sense at that time that this is not what I should be doing? Were you desperate, or were you sort of numb after losing? Like, what are some of the things that went through your mind? I'll start with Jamar there.
For me, and I think what Rochester and people have to understand is a gang's recruitment process is just as strong as the U.S. military. Right? They're going to tell you, just like you see the commercials for the U.S. military on, we're going to offer you this, and it's a family, it's a brotherhood, you're an achiever. That's the same message that these folks have, right? And that's what we believed at that time frame. It was a family setting. It was a bunch of guys that wanted to hang out with us. We had somebody who talked to us like a father figure. Unfortunately, now we know, or, you know, it took some time to understand that, you know, the things that he wanted wasn't right. But at that moment, he was speaking to us. He was speaking to our hearts. And I think a lot of folks have to understand that. Like, kids just don't join gangs because, oh, I'm joining a gang. There's somebody that's recruiting them. And there's somebody that's speaking to a moment in their life, a tragedy in their life, something that's making them resonate that they want to join us.
You want to add to that, Jermaine?
More importantly, like Jamar said, it's looking for someone to acknowledge you. My father was, I don't want to say, people say great man, but my father was an interesting individual. And we really didn't get to spend as much time with him as we liked because he was a working person. You know, he owned multiple businesses. At the same time, he worked for Xerox for 30 years. So we really didn't have uncles in our lives, although I had uncles in my lives. They weren't in the life, in our life, excuse me. So it was really just gravitating towards people who, hey, Jermaine, how you doing today, brother? How you doing? You know, we really didn't need money, but somebody would say, hey, man, here's a dollar to go to the store and get a bag of chips. You know, you at 11, you're like, oh, I'm gonna give me some barbecue chips. You know, I'm good.
Yeah.
You know, some juicy juice, whatever. You know, that's what attracts kids. And that's what it was.
And now here you are with this awards program that helps in so many ways change some of the public perception, break down the stereotypes. Before we get there, how did you kind of get away from that lifestyle?
For me, it was, we were both smart. You know, it used to drive my mother crazy that we were both smart. We both had straight A's in school,
crazy.
You know, all the way up. And we had like the city school district suspension record. And every night we used to come home and she'd be sitting there crying because she really didn't know what to do. Like, do I beat them? But I can't because they passed on with straight A's, you know. And I really didn't realize it until maybe 6 years ago when, you know, I cried just thinking of that, you know, the emotion that I put my mother through. But to answer your question, it was two people who came in my life when I was in 7th and 8th grade who told me that you have great leadership potential, but you're using it wrong. You know, let's direct your leadership potential, the qualities that you have, and let's steer it to something positive. And that's what they did. They started getting us involved in different programs.
Teen court.
I did engineering. I did science programs. I did math programs. They start taking us on field trips to different places, things to really, I mean, you had no reason to be out there in the streets because you was always busy.
They showed us that the world was so much bigger than our zip code. The only thing we could imagine was 14621. We didn't realize there was a Pittsburgh. There's Greece. We didn't see that because, unfortunately, our father passed away at a young age. For me, there was a program that I was placed in called Work Scholarship, Hillside Work Scholarship. And I was given a youth advocate who followed me around everywhere. And at first, it was like, oh, man, this guy's chasing me. But you begin to realize that my youth advocate at the time, he was very genuinely interested in making sure that I succeeded. I remember when our mother needed to go to the grocery store. She was sick, and we didn't have a vehicle. You know, he would take her grocery shopping. I mean, he would check on us. He would go get our report card. And if there was an issue, as we said, we were suspended from school multiple times, he would be that person that would try to understand the situation and would be that advocate and help my mother understand, you know, this is what's going on. Maybe let's approach it this way. And then I got a job, right? And I got a job at a couple of places, really, because we had to work.
That's what my dad told us. Work, work, study, study.
You know, we had to really survive. We had to help pay rent. We had to help pay all these bills. And mind you, we're young. Kids shouldn't be having these responsibilities. But they do. And I got a job, and I ended up meeting some wonderful people. And I'm very honored that one of those folks is in this room right now. So,
well, for me, I'm sorry. It was Mr. Morita, my 6th grade teacher, and then Bert Alexander, who got me involved in the RIT pre-freshman engineering program, and then 8th grade, Millich Griffin for the prison program. So I remember
the
those.
The prison program?
Prison program. Program interesting students in science and math and engineering. Those three individuals helped shape my life.
And that's another edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and WEOS, that's Finger Lakes Public Radio 89.5 FM.
You can also hear us on the WXXI mobile app. He's Evan, I'm Megan. Have a great weekend, everybody, and we'll talk to you Monday.